Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, Chancellor Rachel Reeves has confirmed plans to slash the welfare bill by £3.4 billion, which could push over 250,000 people into relative poverty by 2930. We'll be speaking to a disability campaigner about the real-life impact of these decisions.
Plus, the daughter of the woman who was the inspiration for Ask for Angela has called on the government to do more to ensure the scheme is implemented correctly. Well, we'll be joined by a women's rights campaigner to discuss whether the scheme is still fit for purpose.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first is The Week Unwrapped.
I built the group. My job is to make sure everything's coordinated.
But how did I don't mean to be pedantic here, but how did the number
have
get
you ever had
chat?
Have you ever had somebody's contact that shows their name and then you have somebody else's number there?
Oh, I never make those mistakes.
Right? You got somebody else's number on someone else's contact. So, of course, I didn't see this loser in the group. It looked like someone else. Now, whether he did it deliberately or it happened in some other technical mean is something we're trying to figure out.
This is an extraordinary story. U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz has accepted full responsibility after a journalist was added to a group chat of top officials discussing strikes in Yemen. Atlantic magazine editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg reported that he saw classified military plans for U.S. strikes in Yemen, including weapons packages, targets, and timing 2 hours before the bomb struck. President Trump downplayed the incident as a witch hunt and blamed the messaging app Signal as potentially being defective. Ali, we've all sent messages to the wrong people. I know I have. But like more in year seven when I accidentally texted the guy I fancied about him rather than my best friend.
Yeah. What did you say?
About him.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah.
In comparison, how damaging is this?
I think probably equally damaging.
to be fair.
Yeah. So they've denied that. First of all, this is something I would do. I just want to put that out there. This is like a classic thing that would happen in my life, although I probably wouldn't be exchanging classified information. Yeah.
Why you aren't president of the United States, right?
I'm looking at this screenshot now. So it says things like 12:15, F-18s launch, first strike package, 4:220, more F-18s launch, drone strikes at 2:15. It's got really detailed, obviously classified information in there. And what's remarkable about this story is, do you remember the Republican outcry over Hillary Clinton's use of personal emails, for example, and the classified information that was in personal emails? When that was happening, it was lock her up. But now that Mike Waltz has clearly shared classified information about a very serious topic in a WhatsApp group, suddenly it's a witch hunt, and everyone is being blamed, including Signal, as being potentially defective. What's been interesting is they've used the same sort of strategy they always do, which is just attack the person asking the question. And from the best of my knowledge, the Atlantic editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, he didn't report it until after the strikes, right? So he actually took quite an ethical approach of not releasing classified information. I guess he might have been in a bit of trouble if he'd done it after. Talk to me as a journalist. How can you imagine the gold mine, like the light bulb that went up above his head when he realised he'd been...
Yeah, I mean, he's written a great piece, right, in The Atlantic about what happened. And
the headline is amazing, by the way.
Yes.
The Trump administration accidentally texted me its war plan.
I mean, listen, yeah, you're right. As a journalist, this is almost like every journalist's wet dream, right?
Yeah.
To have stumbled on not only really interesting information about how the government works, but to also be at the center of a huge mistake that the government has made and government officials have made, which has nothing to do with you. It's not your own fault, but you've stumbled on it. I mean, that's great. The problem is he's dealing with a bunch of psychopaths, right?
Yeah.
So my first reaction on behalf of Jeffrey Goldberg was, oh my God, he's brave to come public about this, because we know how vengeful this this administration is. Can I just say, there are some really serious details in this that are matters of national security, really important. But the thing that made me wince above all else, right, was Steve Witkoff responding to the strikes with five emojis, two hands praying, a flexed bicep, and two American flags. I mean, these men are so cringeworthy. They're just like a bunch of dude bros, like high-fiving God bless America over strikes in Yemen. I mean, it's insane that government is being, I mean, we knew it, but it is insane to see government being done on this kind of level.
Do you know what it shatters? Because there's this, it reminds me a little bit of the conversations around Keir Starmer before the election. There's this hope that you have that the way these guys behave in public is just a pretense and they're much more responsible and serious behind the scenes. And the problem is this WhatsApp group kind of shatters that illusion that, you know, maybe they're playing a character on TV that's for electoral purposes, but behind the scenes, they understand the gravity of the power that they now pose. And you're absolutely right. Some of these, some of the comments that they make in it, and the way that they discuss bombing human beings is not just crass, but it shatters that illusion that they're very serious behind the scenes. The other question is, you know, this is the group chat that we've seen, but how extensively are they using things like Signal to discuss classified information? And if so, is it being compromised elsewhere?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm sure we'll come back to this. I doubt this is the end of the incompetence of the Trump administration, but let's move on to something closer to home. So in a week that saw her slash billions from the welfare budget, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, has defended her decision to accept tickets worth £600 to watch Sabrina Carpenter at the O2.
Why are free clothes a no-no, but free concert tickets is a yes, please?
I went with a member of my family to see a concert a couple of weeks ago. I do now have security, which means it's not as easy as it would have been in the past to just sit in a concert, although that would probably be a lot easier for everyone concerned. So, look, I took those tickets to go with a member of my family. I thought that was the right thing to do from a security perspective.
Did you pay for them? Because you could pay for them.
Well, these weren't tickets that you could pay for. So there wasn't a price to those tickets. Obviously, I will declare that the value of them, but they weren't tickets that you were able to buy.
The Chancellor argued that the tickets were necessary for security reasons, but has said she will not accept free tickets in the future. So Keir Starmer tightened rules on ministers accepting gifts and hospitality last year, following a backlash over senior Labour figures receiving freebies. We'll talk about this, Ali, but I just want to make a point because this really annoys me. So they were talking about this on Politics Live on the BBC the other day. And one right-wing Telegraph journalist said, well, my biggest question is what the Chancellor of the Exchequer is doing going to see Sabrina Carpenter, you know, and then they all did a bit of a chortle. Ha ha ha, I would never go see Sabrina Carpenter. That is not the issue at hand. And I just want to say, I do find that there is a lot of misogyny steeped in that kind of level of commentary. Why would, let's just take Rachel Reeves out of the equation. Sabrina Carpenter is a very successful pop star. Yes, her music is aimed at young women. That doesn't mean it is not going to be an amazing gig. Yeah. And it was the same when, you know, Sir Keir Starmer went to see Taylor Swift. That whole, oh, why would he want to see Taylor Swift? I don't know, because she's the biggest female artist at this moment in time. She's the biggest pop star. So I just want to get that out there because that's been really annoying me. Like the sort of snobbery around music that teenage girls would like. Yeah. It doesn't mean it's not good music.
So I was going to ask who Sabrina, I know who Rachel Reeves is. I was going to ask who Sabrina Carpenter is, but
don't make me do my rant at you.
Yeah.
But she's very good. I'm going to send you home with homework to watch on YouTube.
I will say, it's really funny that you say on this Politics Live, this Tory or right-wing journalist who you can't even
columnist
remember.
Columnist for The Telegraph.
I don't know if you can remember their name, but most people wouldn't know who they are.
I can tell you it was Fraser Nelson.
Actually,
it wasn't Fraser Nelson. It was Tim Stanley.
Oh, Tim Stanley. Yeah. I can guarantee you most people in this country have no idea who Tim Stanley is, but most will know who Sabrina Carpenter is, and certainly everybody will know who Taylor Swift is. Yeah, I think you're 100% right. I find it hilarious that some of these commentators who, like, with all due respect, are losers, laughing and going to a Sarah Carpenter.
Let's talk about the substance, concept. Though. Yeah. Rachel Reeves. Yeah. I mean, what is she doing?
I can't believe she's done this again. Like, what do they not understand about how damaging this was the first time round? To just pay for the fucking tickets. You get paid, like, £120,000 a year. You can afford £600 tickets. You can buy box tickets. It's just simply not true to say you can't buy box tickets. You can buy specific box tickets. And the thing I would say is, look, security is definitely an issue. That's true, right? But if you can't pay for your own ticket as a result of security issues, just don't go. That's part of the sacrifice of public office, if I'm honest.
Do you really think that she shouldn't be able to go watch Sabrina Carpenter?
Not on... As a freebie ticket, no.
No, not as a freebie. So if she insisted on paying for it.
Yeah, if she paid for the box seats, no problem at all.
But do we really think she's being influenced by Sabrina Carpenter?
No, but what I think... No, we don't. Right? But what I think this does is I think it's better to have a hard rule on these sorts of things. Because what will happen in the future is... And I'm not saying this has ever happened, but just as an example, Google might send you Sabrina Carpenter tickets, or Apple might send you Sabrina Carpenter tickets, and as a result might want a meeting about something else. We know that that's how Westminster works. And more than anything, I'm not a big proponent of, like, the way things look. I'm actually much more of a proponent of the way things are as opposed to the way things look. But the way things look are really important in cases like this because it underlines public confidence in the government, right? If people think that you're being influenced by money, even if it's not true, the thinking damages our democracy.
Yeah.
What's really pissed me off about this is how did they not learn their lesson over the summer about this?
Yeah. Well, this to me is the key point, right?
It's the way that they answer the question that pisses me off. Like, what else do you expect me to do? Not go to Sabrina Carpenter?
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think there is an issue with MPs or ministers going to watch gigs. No. I think that is part of the culture.
And I can understand a bit more personality.
Understand the issue over security.
Yeah.
My issue is this was a whole row. Rachel Reeves was about to unveil a very contentious budget. She just slashed billions from the welfare budget, took money from disabled people. Come on, use your brain.
Yeah.
You don't need to go see Sabrina Carpenter, or if you do, just pay for your ticket. Pay for your ticket.
It's just crass.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, moving on. The environmental campaign group Just Stop Oil have announced they will be ceasing direct action after a final protest in London next month. The group said their initial demand to end new oil and gas is now government policy, making us one of the most successful resistant campaigns in history. So, is it the end of soup on Van Gogh's, cornstarch on Stonehenge, and slow marching in the streets? But it is not the end of trials, of tagging and surveillance, of fines, probation, and years in prison. Ali, what do you think Just Stop Oil's legacy will be?
I don't mean to be making light of a lot of the topics that are very serious that we're talking about, but I think it's quite funny that they will cease direct action, but one final protest.
I know. It's very Just Stop Oil, actually.
It's like, you know, when I'm going on a diet to lose weight, but I'll start on Saturday. Let me have a big meal on
first.
Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair play. I mean, look, the way that they framed it is right. That there's no doubt that whether you agree with their methods or not, that they have pushed the environmental conversation to the top of the agenda. And a lot of people will be saying, you know, they may have turned people off their message by the nature of their direct actions. But the point that they will make, and actually history makes, is that you're very rarely successful if you're sort of docile and playing to the masses. You have to have a bit of edge to you. You have to have these sort of civil resistance campaigns have to have an element of civil disobedience, but also disturbance. And so I think they're framing it in a quite interesting way. The worry is, I do think that the state has been very heavy-handed in the way that they have dealt with them in the judicial system. actually one of the activists that we interviewed on the show, it must be nearly a couple of years ago now, got a 2-year sentence for the, I think it was for the soup on Van Gogh. They got a 2-year prison sentence for that. And meanwhile, we have people of serious violence cases getting less than that. And I think there's a general conversation around the way that direct action protest and these forms of non-violent resistance in the country for all manner of political issues are being clamped down on, being a threat to security. We've just seen how the Palestine protesters have been dealt with as well. I think there's a genuine sort of worry there. How do you think they'll be remembered if this is the sort of end of their sort of direct action?
I don't know if people will necessarily attribute Just Stop Oil with the fact that the government decided to end new oil and gas licenses.
No, and to be fair, I don't think the government have decided to take that decision because of Just Stop Oil. But there's certainly one variable.
But I think you're right that they increase the salience of the issue.
Yeah.
And definitely got some good laughs out of right-wing commentators on LBC.
Yeah,
being
a meltdown.
Absolutely incandescent.
Yeah.
At washable cornstarch on Stonehenge. I mean, for God's sake, who cares? Okay, that is the week unwrapped. Coming up, we're going to talk about Rachel Reeves confirming plans to majorly cut the welfare bill. We'll be joined by a disability campaigner to discuss how these cuts will affect those who rely on benefits to live and work. We'll be discussing all that next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on Fubar Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that you did Strictly Come Dancing?
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. It won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours out, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh. And Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Well, it was the spring statement yesterday, and Rachel Reeve has confirmed huge cuts to the welfare budget. Declaring Labour was the party of work, the Chancellor announced the health element of universal credit will be frozen for new claimants and halved for current, while the basic rate of universal credit will rise by £14 a week by 2029 to 30. According to the government's own analysis, these cuts mean more than 3 million families will lose an average of £1,720 a year in real terms, with an extra 250,000 people falling into relative poverty by 2029 to 30. Early this week, Darren Jones was forced to apologise after he compared disability benefit cuts to children's pocket money. He, of course, is a Treasury minister. So how out of touch are the Labour Party when it comes to these cuts, and what impact will they have on those who claim benefits? Well, joining us now is Sophia Kleanthos, who is a disability campaigner and trustee for Inclusion London. Sophia, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us what were your initial thoughts on what you heard in the spring statement on Wednesday.
Thank you very much. I think the large sort of sentiment around with the disability community was effectively horrified that Labour would do this. A very large number of people are going to be put into poverty, and those costs won't go away. They will actually be displaced onto other services. So services like the NHS, emergency services, housing services, that are already at their breaking point. It doesn't get rid of costs. In fact, evidence from the MS Society recently looked at and researched into people who had lost or had downgraded from disability living allowance to PIP. And at the very max, they were looking at 10,000 people. They looked at the impact of that previously on the two NHS services and the A&E. And they looked that an additional impact of 7 million a year was going to be put on those services. So that's just that side of things. And we're talking about large numbers of people who are going to be severely impacted by this.
Sophia, I wonder if you can speak to the fact that this is happening by a Labour government. This is the sort of thing we would expect from a pretty hard right Tory government, but it's coming from a Labour Party that has always branded itself as sort of caring for the most vulnerable in our society. How does it feel, and what is the view of, and you can't speak on behalf of the whole disabled community, but on how this is being viewed coming from a Labour prism?
Yeah, I thank you very much for that. I would say as a previous Labour voter myself, as someone who was part of the Labour Party, I was involved in quite a lot of Labour movements, and I have removed myself from those as a result of quite a lot of different things that the Labour Party have done. I think there's been a lack of a general consensus of shock, being appalled. These are cuts are actually worse than Osborne's cuts in welfare changes in 2015. And it's not a statement that any of us, I think, really thought we would be saying. There's also potential changes to access to work, and they're launching a consultation. And access to work is basically the benefit that supports people in work and gives us reasonable accommodations and adjustments. So it's very clear that this isn't about, you know, saving money. This is all coming in the same time as the assisted dying bill going through and the big protections that were protecting disabled people, mental health, people with mental health, and those who are homeless being included from all being removed. So I think very much it feels, and this I'm not talking for every disabled person, but I think in the community there's a feeling of the idea that, you know, we have a campaign called Assist Us to Live, and it feels like it's the opposite currently.
The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has said that the welfare cuts are about reforming a system that discourages people from working, and that his party believes in the dignity of work. But obviously, people who claim PIP say that the cut to the benefit would actually have the opposite effect, and that it could force disabled people out of work and prevent disabled people from getting work in the first place. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the statistics that the government are kind of sharing are incorrect. Overall, the welfare bill is not increasing, and after cuts, it will be actually decreasing. There's an increase in claims by disabled people due to the cost of living crisis.
Sorry, Sophia. I just wanted to clarify on that point. Is that because, it might be increasing, but is that because it's not increasing relative to other costs? Is that correct? Can you explain why they've got that discrepancy?
Yeah, so there's a lot of aspects of this, to be honest. So recently the pension age changed, which means that more people were now a part of that group. So more people were able to claim because they weren't part of the pension group. There's also the concern that the government has had around this forcing getting people to work. But evidence has shown that actually removing PIP reduces people's access to work. We have a lot of case studies of people who had to stop working because their PIP was reduced. People are dependent on using PIP both in work and out of work. PIP is not an out of work benefit. Mm. It's actually a benefit for helping support disabled people for the extra costs of being disabled. So things like extra therapies, transport, and any other kind of interventions that disabled people need. And I myself have actually used PIP both in work and out of work.
Mm. Sophia, can I ask, one of the frustrations I have is when this is discussed on mainstream media, a lot of times we talk about these things in big numbers and in big scale, but I'm interested in how this affects a disabled person in their day-to-day life, but also how it's made you feel in all the discussions around it, all the briefings that have happened and all the, what we've heard, the anxiety that's been caused. Can you tell us a little bit about what you expect life to be like when these cuts come in and how the discussion around disabled people has made you feel in the media?
Thank you. It's a discussion that I've been really upset to see. I think also there's a point as disabled people that we want to be seen as experts of our own experience, not just experts of our lived experience of being disabled and being in the benefit system, but also policy experts. Mm-hmm. So being asked policy analysis questions are very important to remove the infantilization that is going on of disabled people. In terms of my own impact, I will probably lose my PIP. It's currently the only income I have because I had to leave my job as a result of my health deteriorating, which I'm trying to now get back into work. The government talking about, you know, pushing people into work, but we've also looked at the fact that some disabled people could lose up to 60% of their income through PIP or the WCA changes. And just the fact that we've heard Rachel Reeves in the last few days talking and other MPs talking about it's like taking away pocket money for children. Mm. It feeds into the very, very damaging narrative that disabled people are children. But actually PIP is helping us stay alive in many situations, able to be in work or support us when we're out of work, but it's not an out of work benefit. And what has been very, very concerning is how disabled people are being talked about, effectively saying the severely disabled are the only people that deserve to be helped. My message to that is that if one of us suffers, we all suffer as a community. The disability community is about a community. Yesterday, we were protesting against the government, disabled people against cuts, and I was also supporting Inclusion London as a trustee. And we were basically calling on the government to understand and the wider public to understand, to come together, because this is not just going to affect disabled people. And that is one of our biggest messages. It's going to affect the NHS, as I've said, which means that there'll be less support and services for people who aren't being affected by this directly and will be indirectly affected. The NHS will be affected. Housing will be affected. And we're sort of seeing that what we need is funding public services, making work accessible and getting employers to meet their legal obligations, because it's all fine and well saying, oh, well, disabled people need to go into work. Actually, a lot of disabled people are in work. PIP is not an out-of-work benefit, as I've said. But also, we need to have actual accessible workplaces. A colleague in the Disabled People's Poverty Action Group actually did an analysis on this. And she looked into all of the jobs on the government's website and worked out how many of those jobs that were disability confident employers that were on the government website, and how many of them were actually accessible and remote. Of the ones that she found, 104 jobs came back as being remote. But she then looked into every single one of those jobs, and only 23 were only fully remote. So these roles need to be created, but employers need to be actually given and ensure that they have legal obligations and make sure that access to work is supported to ensure disabled people who can work are able to and are not removed because of an inaccessible environment.
Sophia, thank you so much for your time. That was Sophia Kleanthos, the Disability Campaign and Trustee for Inclusion London. Ali, we obviously just heard from Sophia there, talking about the real-life impact of the Spring Statement. What did you make of the things she was saying? I mean, particularly about the kind of the experience of disabled people who are fearing losing PIP, the way that disabled people are spoken about, and the kind of wider policy environment, which is that workplaces aren't disability accessible. Mm-hmm. The NHS and social care are not equipped to deal with people who aren't getting support from the welfare state but need it. And of course, the wider policy context, which I found really interesting, which was that this is happening at the same time we're having a conversation about assisted dying, we're having a conversation about the mental health bill. What did you take away from Sophia?
I think the point is, it's very hard, even for the most ardent Keir Starmer supporter and Rachel Reeves supporter right now, to argue against the notion and the lived experience of people like Sophia, who are telling us that this is clearly a political choice that is going to push them into greater hardship, poverty, possibly even people losing their lives as a result. There was a UN report that came out about the era of austerity, the Osborne era of austerity, and the number of disabled people in this country that died as a result of the sort of environment and the cuts that were being made. I think this has to be placed in the context of the decisions that are being made. Keir Starmer was a big proponent of the message of politics is about choices when he was in opposition. And I think the fact that this is all happening around the time of the assisted dying bill, the fact that it's all been leaked in advance of the spring statement and the anxiety that that's caused, and then you kind of mirror that with the fact that there's all these discussions about digital taxes being slashed for big tech companies, the tech bros, if you will, it does seem like a very cruel, completely un-Labour, goes against every fabric of the history and traditions of the Labour Party to, in one hand, hand tax cuts to tech bros, and on the other hand, snatch the vital, life-saving sort of assistance that disabled people will need. It is cruel, it's crass, and I think it's punching down at the most vulnerable in our society that is the antithesis to why the Labour Party exists. What do you think?
I mean, it's probably worth saying that with the digital services tax, the government are not, while they are not ruling it out, cut to the digital services tax, they have also not said that they will, but there are rumours about it.
Yeah, they've not denied it either, which they would usually do.
How damaging do you think that would be to public confidence in the government if, in order to circumvent Trump's tariffs, they did concede and they did give tax cuts to tech bros while taking money away from disabled people, while taking money away from vulnerable pensioners, while taking money, I mean, I care less about this, but the farmers. Yeah. I mean, my point is there are lots of groups who they have upset. If they are then, as you say, giving handouts, tax cuts, whatever you call it, to the likes of Elon Musk, what would that do to a Labour government?
I think it would cement, you know, we used to call the Conservative Party the nasty party.
Yeah.
How do you fight off against that sort of branding for Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves if a year into their government we've seen the two-child limit, which pushes children into poverty, maintained, the winter fuel allowance, which many argued pushes elderly people into poverty, and disabled welfare cuts that target disabled communities, pushing them into poverty and hardship, all the while you're handing millions of pounds in tax write-offs and tax cuts to some of the richest tech companies in the world? How do you not become the nasty Prime Minister and the nasty Chancellor? Right? So I think it would be a massive PR and real problem, if that makes sense. Because these are choices that you're making. Labour is making, this Labour Chancellor and government are making a conscious choice not to introduce a wealth tax that other countries have introduced as a way to pay for things like defence spending, right? We saw how quickly they went and found the money in the international aid budget for increasing defence. So it is all about political choices, and they're making all the wrong choices.
Mm.
How much do you think it's a PR problem? Or PR makes it sound like I'm undermining the reality of the policy issue. I'm not, but the way they're viewed around the country, how much do you think that will affect? Because some people think this is the right thing to do, right? Some people think that people are abusing this system. I've seen the sort of nutter right wingers saying, you know, all you have to do is say you have ADHD and they give you a BMW. That sort of idiotic.
I think the problem with the digital service tax is there's no counterfactual. So, you know, if they were to offer a tax cut, it would, the reasoning behind it would be that that is necessary to avoid the turmoil that would be caused by Trump tariffs, so you have to appease. But I think,
but it's not just that policy issue. It's also, look at the way that they've spoken about it.
But
in
this,
public.
But this is
like Torsten Bell on Newsnight the other week. Darren Jones.
Well, this is the point I was going to make actually, which is that as much as that could be true, and people I think generally do understand that you have to appease Trump to some extent because he does hold a lot of power and we are in economic constraints, at the same time, if you keep being so willing to direct the cuts at vulnerable people while seemingly being so happy to offer tax cuts to the richest, I think that is going to do terrible things to voters who are leaving Labour and turning to Reform and turning to other parties and other alternatives. Mm. It's this trying to tread the centre ground that I think people are getting really sick of. And I think, you know, I really do think that complying to the demands of Musk, Trump, etc. over a digital services tax could be actually ending for the Labour Party. I think it could really destroy the party, tear it in two, and be the trigger that caused them to lose a lot of votes, because it's this in comparison to the disability stuff that really hits home, not with just core voters, but with voters across the country who don't like Musk, they don't like big tech, they don't like Donald Trump.
I mean, the other problem in terms of votes isn't out in the public, it's in the chamber. There's a lot of dissenters right now around this, these welfare cuts from MPs, and again, not from the usual dissenters on the left.
Absolutely. Okie doke. Coming up, should we still be asking for Angela, or do we need more radical change to protect women at night? All that and more next.
FUBAR Radio. Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
And I know conversion therapy doesn't work because one of the most popular conversion therapy camps in America, I watched a documentary, it is a 2-week long program. They all share a room for the week. Now, look, I don't want to insinuate too much, but my one hope is that if they do get caught, they adopt a parenting tactic of making them smoke the whole packet. Oh, you like sucking cock, do you? Well, you're not leaving this room until all of these cocks have been sucked.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't. Think.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Mr. Later Williams, hello! Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. Won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, the daughter of Angela Crompton, the inspiration behind the Ask for Angela scheme, has called for government action to ensure it's being implemented properly. An undercover investigation by the BBC found that over half the venues visited in London failed to respond to the code word, with similar findings being reported across the UK. The Nighttime Industries Association has urged the safeguarding minister and local authorities to move beyond outdated performative approaches to safety and commit to real cultural change. So, is Ask for Angela fit for purpose, or do we need stronger safeguarding measures to protect women at night? Joining us now is Jess Lee, women's rights campaigner. Hi, Jess. Tell us, does Ask for Angela work?
Ask for Angela only works if people know what the scheme is. And like with anything we're talking about, gender inequality, women's rights, that has to start with education. If people don't understand what sexual harassment is or the signs of sexual violence, then Ask for Angela will never do its full job. So at the moment, sadly, I don't think it does what it needs to do.
If I may ask, I think... We've spoken about gender-based violence a lot on the show, and some of the numbers that I've seen, as people like Zoe and others have educated me over the years, are pretty horrific, particularly showing that about 1.5 women a week are killed by current partners or former partners, or violence of men against women, basically, which is a horrific sort of data set to see. Do you think as a society we have dealt with violence against women better over the years, or does it feel we're sliding back a little bit now?
It's hard because I have this conversation every day with young people and the same answers tend to come up. About 4 years ago when Sarah Everard was murdered by a police officer, everybody was talking about it. And then when adolescents came back again, everyone's talking about it. Now this new limited series has come out. But actually, the same root causes exist, and that's of gender inequality and power. When I talk to young people, I'm not seeing a reduction in violence or harassment or in the rates that they're facing, inequality, being a girl or being a boy. I'm actually seeing an increase, which is really, really scary. I think unless the government takes some really bold moves in tackling gender inequality from a young age, not just kind of in pubs and clubs and places of work, actually in schools as well, we're not going to start to see a difference. And with the online world only ever increasing, it is just going to get worse.
Yeah, Jess, you've just mentioned there things that the government can do. If I was to appoint you right now, sort of Prime Minister, President and Queen of the United Kingdom, so you have all power, what's the ideal you want to see happen?
Very simple, and that is education. So I work with different organisations like Bold Voices, Our Streets Now, and we go into schools and we teach young people about gender inequality, about incel culture, about stereotypes, about gender-based violence. And the change that we see in those young people over just an hour is nothing short of magnificent. But we cannot go into every school without proper funding. Schools shouldn't be paying for this out of pocket. Governments, councils should be funding this. That is the number one thing that we can do, is better education. So that of education, we've got nothing.
I want to ask you particularly about the Ask for Angela initiative, because in a previous life, I worked in several bars and pubs. And one of the bars I worked in did have the Ask for Angela initiative. And to the credit of my manager, they did tell me that when I joined and started working there, that we were part of the scheme. And they said, if anything happens, just come. If someone asks for Angela, come to me or come to another manager. So, but nobody ever did ask for Angela. And we did have stickers in the bathroom, in the girls' bathrooms, and potentially in the men's bathrooms as well. I wonder now if part of it, and I'd be interested to get your view on this, is that, you know, the talks in this BBC article about people going up to the bar, asking for Angela, and staff not knowing what to do, not knowing what the scheme is, not having clearly been told. But I also wonder if part of it is that, A, employees are often overworked and underpaid. B, there's a high turnover, we know, in hospitality. So even if there was awareness of the initiative, the manager who knew about it might have moved on and failed to pass that knowledge on. And C, a feeling that even if they were to try and help that person, it could be very, very difficult. You don't know if the person they're involved with is going to be dangerous, violent. It could be that members of staff are all women as well and feel unable to take on a perpetrator like that. There's also a feeling that the police might not even respond because, quite frankly, the police barely turn up to any crime these days. So while I completely agree with you that education is a big thing, there are broader societal issues here as well, aren't there? I mean, there's a lack of policing, a lack of, that kind of bystander effect as well. I mean, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, Ask for Angela shouldn't have to exist because we would be doing enough work in our world, in our schools, in our workplaces, that prevention would be enough. The fact that Ask for Angela does exist is a really, really, really sad reality, yeah. First and foremost. Second, we know that laws don't solve everything. Police don't solve everything. Some people can't go to the police because of institutional racism. Some people can't go to the law because they're undocumented migrants. Like, all of these things are so complex. I think Ask for Angela should be an absolute last resort, because you're right, you don't know what that perpetrator might do. Do they know the person? Will they follow them home? Will it make it worse? It's so risky reporting harassment as it is. There needs to be so much more done, like on the ground, in prevention, training managers, training employees, and giving them the time and space to be able to understand what sexual harassment looks like so they can spot it before somebody needs to ask for help as well.
Jess, should we be linking this to licensing of facilities, bars, nightclubs and other things? Should it be a prerequisite of their alcohol license and their late night license that they have at least some form of safety scheme for violence against women?
Absolutely. If I had it my way, everybody would be learning about it from every workplace, because we know it does exist. Just like you have to have a license to understand how to use alcohol, like what that means. You have training for food hygiene. There should be training for how to deal with sexual violence and sexual harassment, because it is a sad reality that happens to far too many people, which means statistically it probably will happen in a pub or in an institution at least once, if not more.
Because, for example, I mention football a lot on the show. I've got football coaching badges. I can't coach a football team unless I do my health and safety in terms of looking after the players. So surely a venue should have the same, with one of the biggest problems that are likely to happen in their venue, right?
Yeah, and we have the same issue, like universities. Consent training universities is not a requirement, it's optional. And you find that consent training is done by those who are victims of sexual violence in the first place. The people who do need to do it don't tend to do it because it's optional. But again, in my world, every media producer, every news radio person would just have the bare basic knowledge about what it means to kind of spot sexual violence, how to deal with harassment and use the correct language when talking about it. We are a far world away from gender equality, nearly 200 years according to stats. So we have to start taking drastic measures now on all of these schemes to be able to better serve everybody.
Jess, thank you so much. That was Jess Lee, a women's rights campaigner, talking about the Ask for Angela scheme.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio.
That was an interesting stat at the end, wasn't it? 200 years away from gender equality. Yeah. I thought that was fascinating. I've never heard it put that way before. I think she made lots of really interesting points. To me, you know, speaking from my experience of having worked in bars and clubs, if somebody had genuinely come up to the bar and ever used this scheme, I would have known what it was. I just wouldn't have known what to do. Say my manager wasn't working that night. You know, there was a couple of places I worked where eventually I just sort of became the de facto manager one night because the other was off, so I was in charge of closing up. There was no contingency plan. You know, there was all it was make sure you count the cash and put it in the safety deposit box and lock up. There was no, oh, and if this happens, you do know to ring the police.
Yeah, it baffles me that, though, because presumably when you worked, I've never worked in a bar, but I did manage a bar sort of quasi when I was SU president with the student bar. I was actually legally responsible for that. But when you worked at this bar, did you have like fire drills and things like
no.
that?
No.
No? Oh, so
I mean, I worked... You know,
the thing is, the reason I ask is we most places I assume would have some sort of fire code, at least legally. They'd have some sort of safety code for the money, for example, some, like practices. You're much more likely to have an incident of violence against a woman on your premises than you are fire. So surely that should be a mandatory statutory requirement to have some sort of, you know, scheme or safety.
I've worked in different sort of establishments. I worked in busy sort of student bars and I worked in pubs in the countryside, and they have very different ways of operating,
right.
You know, they don't, but I think there's another key point here, which is the insecurity of hospitality.
Yeah.
Staff are so transient in the hospitality sector. You know, they come and they can be gone months later for a variety of reasons. The idea that you can keep that institutional knowledge, you know, and have a system in place of hierarchy, I think it's just, it's an indication of how insecure hospitality has become.
And I imagine if we had someone from the hospitality sector here, they'd say either I don't have the staff or the money to do this. So that should come from government, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was already imagining when you were saying, should this be licensed? Should this be the conditions of their licensing? I could hear the business leaders and the right wingers saying, more regulation, more red tape. But she, you know, Jess was so right in that these are societal problems. They go very, very deep. But if at the very acute end, business managers, business owners who know these incidents are common and occurring in their own establishments don't feel the need to have any procedure in place to prevent them, then surely that is part of the issue. That is an indictment of why these things happen, because it is so trivialised. Violence against women and girls, it's just seen as part and parcel of daily life.
Yeah,
of course somebody's going to get harassed or stalked or, you know, worse in my bar. But that's part of owning a nightclub.
Yeah,
no, it shouldn't be part of owning a nightclub.
So when you said you could hear them saying more regulation, that's true. And I think what undercuts that is exactly what you're saying. They will almost approach this as, well, that's part of, like, you know, that's unfortunately goes with the territory and it shouldn't. Right, like if we're talking about what's likely to happen on your premises, it's probably the highest risk you have of frequency of some form of harassment, most likely to a woman, happening on your premises. So it has to, you have to have some mechanism to deal with that. We introduced Ask Angela in the bar that we had at RSU, and you know, we had lots of turnover with the staff because they're students, so they leave one year and you get new ones, and it seemed to work fine in terms of training them, because it shouldn't be that difficult.
I suspect student institutions would take it more seriously because they have a duty of care.
Yeah.
And obviously this isn't to say that no pubs or bars care about violence against women and girls. Of course they do. And, you know, I've got some really good locals in the area I live where, I mean, I've never had to ask for Angela, but even stuff like they have sanitary products in the toilets, I think indicates a level of care and conscientiousness towards their female members of female customers. But it does really feel like it's very difficult to ask businesses to take responsibility for huge systemic societal issues when they are dealing with all these other issues, you know, the insecurity of hospitality, which was worsened after Brexit, for example. It's just very, very difficult, and it feels like it should be a moral prerogative, but I just don't think people just trivialise it and see it as part of, you know, it's just violence against women and girls as part of daily life.
But I think, as with other policy stuff that we've spoken about, it has to be put into context, and the context is we do live in a time, certainly in my view, disagree with me, but I think you won't disagree with me, but others will, that we are seeing, I think, a massive rise in the radicalization of young men in hating women.
Yeah.
I think I don't know how people could argue against that, but they will. But I think in that context, we need to do much more. Yeah. And what's interesting actually about Jess was when I asked her what she would do, she went straight for education. I would have anticipated, she said, a bunch of money given to organizations to go and implement this at the venues, for example, right? Ask Angela a sort of statutory requirement, all that kind of stuff. But she didn't go there. Mm. She actually went at an earlier intervention point, which is the educational part, which is what we've spoken about before as well.
Yeah, very interesting. I think that is the feeling across women's rights groups and groups campaigning against far-right hate as well, which is that it all starts at schools.
Yeah, and you have to intervene at that point to stop it happening. Although, obviously, it's multifaceted and you want to intervene at the point that the violence is happening as well and the harassment in these venues. We'll keep talking about these issues and much more in the weeks to come. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the shows by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.